Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. You know, last week I had such a good time talking to Orhan Pamuk about The Museum of Innocence, his new novel published by Knopf, and I realized that there were subjects that I want to talk to him about that we couldn't even begin to address. And so this week, once again, Orhan Pamuk, the author of The Museum of Innocence, Nobel Prize winner, author, the other novels began in America, at least with The White Castle, To the Black Book, The New Life, My Name is Red, Snow, and now The Museum of Innocence. Along the way, there are two books, one on Istanbul and one called Other Colors, Essays and a Story. And these take up a question that has been on my mind recently. You know, a member of the Nobel Prize Committee created quite a stir in America around a year ago, saying that he did not feel that in America there was, at this time, a global literature worthy of the Nobel Prize. And you've addressed the issues of creating a national Turkish literature. What is the relationship between a national literature to a global literature?
First, one does not begin writing books concerned and to address these issues. One wants to explore the areas, lives, things you know about lives, things you want to express through literature. Then the more famous you get, the more you begin to get translated, then the issue of representation gets to be troubling. That when I begin writing in Turkey, no one called me a Turkish writer because I was in Turkey addressing the Turkish audience. The more my books begin to get translated, the more the damning problem of representation, which is more grave in non-Western world because languages like, say, Hungarian, even Chinese literature or Finnish literature or Turkish literature or Korean literature is not known. Once you reach America or Europe, that one, now I'm translated to 57 languages, then suddenly the issue of representation begins to poison your book. My Turkish readers are now, unfortunately, looking at my books, reading them as if I'm whispering our private lives to others. First, the invention of national literature is, of course, as we all know, is very close with the invention of the nation, inventing classics, writing about the development of middle classes. But now, in non-Western countries which feel humiliated because they are not represented well in the United States or in Europe, once a novelist translates or is popular outside of his country, all accusations of sugarizing, being occidentalizing, or even if that's not the issue, that your readership, your national readership, begins to read you as a sort of a spy whispering truths about the private life of the nation to others. My jokes, my criticisms, my observations, unfortunately, not all of, by the, all of them, but by some Turkish readers, are read differently. I think this problem is also the other way around, too, that readers say, now European readers, American readers, are also asking, am I authentically writing to the national audience? Or now, am I writing for the Western reader or 57 other countries that my books are read by? These are damning questions. I think the best way to get rid of them, just to, yes, acknowledge them, address them theoretically, identify them, but as you write, forget about them.
You know, I've read all of your books, and this is probably the book that, like Ulysses, would guide a reader through Istanbul. Many of its neighborhoods, the restaurants along the Bosporus, even neighborhoods that are changing begin to change in the book. And it seems to me that our greatest novels often are handbooks to a world that has existed. Joyce famously wanted all of the locations in the Dublin street map to be at least mentioned in Ulysses.
That's what I call the museum quality of the
novels.
Novels preserve the way how we lived, the way how we behaved, the language, the daily language we talked. Margaret Yourcenar, in a very brilliant essay about language in historical novels, addressed this issue, saying that novels also preserve how we talk. Our languages are constantly changing, especially under the influence of television. But we have a way of talking, and then we don't know, but it changes. Novels preserve not only the smells, sights, sounds, of a culture, but also, of course, preserve the language itself. And I care about that. I respect Joyce in his understanding that novels are also, in a way, that's how I put it, museums of daily life, how we relate it to the world.
And I would say that somehow, in literature, as literature progresses postmodernistically, and in America, as America has become a postmodern, or some would say post-capitalist society, details disappear. If you think of our most ultra-mundane writers, as Borges gets older and blinder, the world is no longer the world of knife fights and of tango music, but a genuinely detailless world. As Nabokov gets older there in, is it Geneva? He's no longer writing about Russia or about America. It's a kind of gray place filled with transparent, interpenetrating things. Details become specific, but somehow in the soup of a disappeared world. And what I've been noticing about American literature is that more and more we don't have the encyclopedic novel of a city, because in a sense, the city has, in a metaphysical way, disappeared. It becomes a place that Don DeLillo writes about, full of images and slogans rather than specifics and people.
I agree partly, but on the other hand, this is I'm not that critical of American novel. In the end, human heart is same everywhere. I don't think American literature is so different from other literatures, really. For me, it captures the essence of American life. But that it's such a big market, it has such a big presence, maybe that a Swedish professor was reacting to that.
But I'm thinking about how, if we look at your work in order from the beginning, you begin with a sort of, well, at least as far as American translation is concerned, there are two earlier books, but you begin with a kind of international style. And your movement has been into greater and greater detail about the present, about the place you are. That book that we define as the 19th century novel, it is, as you say, a museum. And this book, The Museum of Innocence, is self-conscious in wanting to be that kind of diorama of life.
It's, yes, I had self-consciously, I was self-consciously aware as I was writing Museum of Innocence to write a panoramic picture of what I have seen in my life. I think all authors have that instinct. It is not one story, but the whole story of the culture and its details that I thought I would write. The story is a pretext for holding all these details, and I, of course, care about the story. And now, in a way, paying attention to details of the beloved is an energy that embraces all the details. In fact, I can say that in my novel, there is a tension between my novel, my heroes. They are in love, or but they cannot make love because of perhaps repressions of a semi-closed Islamic society. But that tension, that energy turns to the details of life, to the city they move in, sometimes hand in hand, sometimes with fighting with each other, sometimes looking at the television in a very ordinary middle-class life, sometimes imagining a future together, sometimes holding hands in a movie house, sometimes with resentment and testing each other's endurance. But love, since it's not expressed and exhausted in lovemaking, in sex, converts into a sort of an embracing of the whole world. This was also a pretext for me to write about the things that I loved and noticed in my life.
I want to talk more about love, but first, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Orhan Pamuk, author most recently of The Museum of Innocence, published by Knopf. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Orhan Pamuk about The Museum of Innocence. Now, we spoke last time about Anna Karenina, about Love in the Age of Cholera, but I would say there is also, in the background of this novel, another, to my mind, very great book, if not specifically, at least its outlines. And that, to me, is A Lover's Discourse by Roland Barthes, mm-hmm. in which he describes love...
Waiting.
Yes, waiting. Waiting, anticipating, dreaming, feeling deprived.
He was so good in that.
The deprivation of love, the turning inward of love, and it's very interesting to me because what I would say about this novel that makes it both an old-fashioned novel but a modern novel as well is that the outside has the inside sewn into it.
I think I'm very happy that you have mentioned Roland Barthes because I would use this as the way Dostoevsky talked about Gogol. We all went out of the coat of Montaigne, patiently analyzing your humanity. And Proust comes from that. Of course, Roland Barthes' A Lover's Discourse comes from that. And then my cruel observation about love pain, how one part of the character's mind is observing the other part of the brain which is badly in love and warning and telling himself not to do that, but inevitably cannot control the part of his spirit that is heavily in love. That is a sort of a mundane observation about not only himself, but about whole humanity. This book, Museum of Innocence, is based on the humanistic, optimistic precept that if I observe myself well and express it, if I observe a man in love well and observe it, I will also express all humanity. There is a mundane side to this book.
And also, I would say, a folkloric side as well, that this woman, about whom we have not said much, that she represents, to some extent, mystery. In the movies, she's simplified and becomes an exterminating angel. She is a...
I like Buñuel's film.
Yes. She is a femme fatale. Mm-hmm. But in the novel, what is not said about her speaks volumes. She seems to be a little bit out of the Turkish equivalent of Chaucer, Patient Griselda.
Mm-hmm.
And she seems as well to have as her secret a word only mentioned once in this novel. Her friend says, she wanted to punish you. We wanted to punish you. The woman as moralizing figure teaching this rich man not that she wants his riches, but that his riches cannot buy certain things.
The ambiguity of the novel, or at least that's what I want to do, is that we are not sure whether she is punishing him or punishing herself.
Yes.
Is whether she is angry with the world that is made, this men's world in an Islamic country in 1970s, although they pretend to be westernized? Is she angry to that, or is he just, like all of us, angry to her fate? Is she expressing her resentment of the structure, system, whatever you call it? Or is she fiercely fighting against all the men that, with even good intentions, suppress her? One thing about this novel, the more someone is in love with a woman, the more they repress her, but without knowing it. That because they want to possess, and the possess is cutting her off from the social life, because woman is not allowed too much space in 1970s Istanbul.
You suggest, in fact, within the novel, that it has not changed much. That when Kemal sees his first intended, the woman he was engaged to,
Sibel.
Yes. She says to him, everything is changed now. And he says in parentheses, it has not. And so what we're talking about is a rather remarkable thing that happens at the end of the novel. The novel is handed to my guest, Orhan Pamuk, to be written. The character, in something that doesn't feel Pirandelloan at all, because this is a real Orhan Pamuk, not the literary one, the character goes to him and asks, will you write a guidebook to my Museum of Love?
And this is the Museum of Innocence we read. But I appear at the end of Snow, but neither in Pirandello kind, nor Borghese, but in a more modest way. It's just I don't want to give the ending, but we need a voice that will sum up, that will tie the unknotted ends of the story. And I like that. I like the old-fashioned way that a 19th century novel, let's say it takes 5 years, 5 months, suddenly the last 5 pages or last 10 pages tells us another 30 years, summing up what happened. This was in, and Turgenev does it. I like it. It also gives us a strong sense of time, inevitability, the ephemeral quality of life, how things change, nothing stays the same. This book, which has that kind of historical, panoramical ambitions, not trying to understand history like Tolstoy, but trying to understand the vanity of human life, I wanted a voice, which happens to be me in a tongue-in-cheek way.
And it seems to me that something you say in an essay at the beginning of Other Colors, you comment, admittedly, paradoxically, that what bores one in life is one of the essential ingredients of making literature. In other words, that literature is somehow made out of the things that infuriate and bore the writer in equal parts.
Yeah, to put it more simply, I'm the kind of person, I sometimes say, I'm a Mediterranean, Middle Eastern guy. I want big families, crowds, a large house, big dinners. I really want that. The more solitary, unfortunately, my life and is going towards, I'm getting more alone because of political pressures or whatever, the more I nostalgically look back at the big crowded family we had. But don't get me wrong, when I was with them, I was also very cynical, very critical. I wanted my loneliness. A strange thing, I know from my heart that I want the community, but as soon as I'm with them, I want to be alone. In fact, what perhaps one wants, the crowd noise of the tender noise of the all-embracing community, family, then with that in mind, go to a room, write about them, observe them, make cynical or compassionate jokes about them. This dilemma of wanting the community, but just like Kemal, being an individual out of community is my life's dilemma.
Yes, and it seems to me that it's one of life's dilemmas altogether. You talk about how at one point André Gide, in his journals, reports on his trip to Turkey, and his responses are entirely negative. He does not like the Turks. He does not like the country. He has nothing good to say, and it is excoriating. Mm-hmm. To some extent, you see, it occurs to me that in time, any place can be turned on. You know, that the comment we began with, for instance, that America is not producing a global literature is very odd because we have...
Yes, America is in fact produced most global literature in the last 20 years. Look, the point is that I write all these books because I feel I am not at home in the world. Writing makes me feel at home, but then my books make me feel happy.
But I'm trying to suggest that maybe suddenly it's felt that America is not at home in the world.
That is a too political observation. America, in fact, sometimes I look at the other way, is too much at home in the world.
Tell me.
That is, that culturally America is what everyone looks at. So America I sometimes think that is American writers and American culture is so comfortable with itself and it deserves that relaxation, that this nervousness I have with my family, with my identity, with my problems of being an individual and being raged about the culture is not maybe that strong here, and it's not maybe a negative attribute that in non-Western countries, writers come from upper classes and they are tormented by that because they feel they do not belong. Here in America, I think writers and readers share the same community, and that makes lends them a comfortable feeling of naivete, I would say. But I may be mistaken about this.
No, but you see, I'm very interested here because it seems to me that one of the components of the Museum of Innocence is innocence, is naivete.
And something I value so much.
Yes, and I think it may be necessary to the creation of a great novel.
A creation of a great literature, and America has it. I think I see that kind of naivete, which you may not say, in Walt Whitman, in Moby Dick, that perhaps America was not invented and exhausted at that time, but I still feel that quality in American literature, which I like and respect so much, this feeling at home. I wouldn't call myself a third world writer, but I can happily accept that I'm a non-Western writer, that we are more tormented, more problematized. For whom are we writing? For do I belong? Political troubles, all sorts of things makes you too self-conscious, too tormented. While here the mutual agreement between the reader and the writer that they also all belong to the same community, same class, same culture, makes writing of books more naive and more easy, which I'm very, I confess, jealous of. That's why I read American novels.
I've been talking with Orhan Pamuk, author most recently of The Museum of Innocence, published by Knopf. Orhan, it's a pleasure to see you again.
It was such a delight to talk. We can talk endlessly, it seems.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Museum of Innocence at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Of the mouse club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.